More Idaho Matters right now. I'm Gemma Gaudette. Boise is home to one of the most accomplished living novelists in the United States. Anthony Doerr's new book, Cloud Cuckoo Land, comes after he won the Pulitzer Prize for his novel, All the Light We Cannot See, back in 2015. And we are lucky enough to have Anthony Doerr live with us on Idaho Matters. Welcome to the program.
Gemma, what's happening? Great to be here.
Oh my gosh. You know, I am so thrilled to be talking to you, honestly. So thank you for taking time out of your day. And before
Thanks for everything you've done through the pandemic. My wife's like a huge fan. She's fangirling about Gemma today.
Okay, that's so crazy because I'm sorry, I'm fangirling about you. So, I mean, you are the bigger deal than me. So, but tell your wife thank you. With that said, before we talk about the new novel, can you talk a little bit about what it's like to win the Pulitzer Prize? I mean, how has life changed? I mean, outside of the pandemic since 2015.
Right. Oh, gosh. You still have to pick up the socks and feed the dogs and pick up the dog food and get your kids to school. So in many ways, life is the exact same. But it certainly brought this huge burst of joy into my family for days. And, you know, there's this amazing gratification. My job is so weird. I work alone all the time in this little space, not very far from you, right by Boise High. And so to get that kind of gratification is, of course, pretty amazing.
You know, what's interesting to me is I must tell you, All the Light We Cannot See is one of the most beautiful books I have ever read. I'm a huge reader. I loved this novel so much. And, you know, it's set in a specific time, right? It's set during World War II. I think it's a time where, at least in the United States and parts of Europe, you can visualize that, you can understand it. But then you do this 180 with this new book. What's it like to go from what you wrote with All the Light We Cannot See to Cloud Cuckoo Land? Because they're so different.
Yeah, they are quite different. In many ways, they're different. But in other ways, they're still just about my preoccupations with our current predicaments. And, you know, All the Light really for me started with radio. What this amazing technology that you and I are using right now, this invisible light is traveling, carrying your voice at the speed of light into people's homes. And that is such a miracle. And I wanted to try to remind readers that for most of humanity, this technology didn't exist. And here comes this new technology into the 20s and 30s in Europe and really disrupts power structures and changes the way information and the truth exists in the world. And so that project and All the Light, I really kind of carried forward in Cloud Cuckoo Land. Cloud Cuckoo Land really started with a different, really disruptive time, the 15th century. This is when the printing press is arriving. This is when suddenly the quote unquote new world and old world are mixing. There's ideas traveling from indigenous peoples into European intellectual circles and vice versa. And there's this thing from China called gunpowder coming into the world. So for centuries upon centuries, walls, defensive walls, really were the preeminent technology to defend a city. And gunpowder spills into Europe. It's always young people that discover the power of new technologies. And there's this young Ottoman Sultan. He's 19 years old, and he leads this humongous army against the walls of Constantinople, which have stood. They withstood 23 sieges. They withstood 1,100 years of history. And inside the walls of that city was this even older technology, this human technology of the book. And as these last copies of ancient texts decayed all over North Africa and Europe, you know, Aristotle from, you know, Sophocles, Aeschylus, these last copies of these books are leaving the world. They're preserved inside these libraries inside Constantinople. So the real project with Cloud Cuckoo Land in some ways was similar to All the Light. Try to find a really interesting period in which a new technology comes and disrupts human culture. And that's how I got started on the project anyway. So they didn't feel too similar to me, at least in the beginning.
That's fascinating. So I have to say, and you know this, your new book has already received high praise by the New York Times, by NPR, other outlets, but you know, we're local. So I want to read an excerpt from a review by local reporter and book lover, Margaret Carmel. She wrote this in the Idaho Press, quote, "Finishing this book makes you consider all those who came behind you and all those who will come after you with a glimmer of hope, despite the challenges we will certainly meet along the way," unquote. I love that idea because I think it gets into one of the themes that you write about in Cloud Cuckoo Land. And this really is about that human connection, right? Even when people are unrelated, we are still so interconnected through time and space.
Absolutely, Gemma. Yeah. Oh, that makes my day. That quote is so nice. Of course, the real project of this novel was to try to suggest, in the way maybe literature, only literature can, that things that you think of as disconnected are deeply connected. If you just think about the technology, the iPhone that I'm using to talk to you right now, you know, there's parts from like 30 different countries in this thing. And there are people who I will never meet who worked on pieces in this phone. Technology sometimes helps conceal all those interconnections from us the way, you know, if you and I go to Albertsons on State and you buy a chicken breast, you don't really get exposed to like the blood and feathers of the bird, or the way I twisted the thermostat this morning and heated up the house because it was a little cold. I wasn't really connected to the energy costs, the fuel that's brought to the house to heat the furnace. And so sometimes technology can conceal those interconnections. And I think it's really important. The pandemic was such a reminder of how a severed life is really an impoverished life. And so training our imaginations to imagine how we're connected to the people around us, and of course, the people who haven't been born yet, I think is a really important way to try to ask yourself, you know, am I being a good ancestor? That kind of classic question that environmentalists ask themselves.
And, you know, speaking of the pandemic, what was your writing experience like during it? I mean, as you mentioned, I mean, you write alone already, right? But now all of a sudden you probably had a lot more people in your house because the kids had to be home. But I mean, how did that impact your whole process?
Yeah. Great question. Of course, you know, doctors and nurses had it so much worse. You know, I mean, in many ways, I was able to just kind of keep going. I felt really grateful that I was kind of downhill on this novel project where most of it was at least pieced together. And so once I got over the initial shock of like, oh my gosh, the kids are going to go to school in their bedrooms, we started to kind of fall into, you know, I like routine. I think routine helps you make art. And if you can kind of keep a steady schedule. So in many ways, the pandemic had a lot of silver linings. After the success of All the Light, I was traveling all the time. And so that, of course, was removed. And often, you know, speaking gigs, you have to plan and prep a speech, and that takes you a week. So I was really able to kind of bear down and finish this book. And also, you know, I've got in middle age, I'm trying to, this whole book was really a journey of middle age for me and try to come to more acceptance primarily that I'm going to die, like my own mortality. Mm-hmm. But also, you know, I had it in my head, maybe from advertising or reading books as a little kid, that like, if you just traveled far enough, if you just got to Bora Bora, if you just got to India, you'd see all these wonderful, magical things. But in the beginning of the pandemic, I realized like just in the foothills, just in the yard around the house, there's so much to observe. And sometimes you can find just as much wonder in the world by just slowing down and watching ants work in your garden for 5 minutes. Or I remember one day when there were no airplanes flying, seeing the snow geese moving towards Oregon, you know, flying west over the foothills in this perfect deep blue sky. And you could hear them honking, even though they're like a half mile above my head. Those moments come to you because you slow down a little bit. So the pandemic really gave us a lot of gifts like that.
Oh my gosh, right? I think for some of us who are privileged enough to have had the pandemic not impact us in ways that it has impacted so many other people, it was that idea of just slowing down for a moment and I think reconnecting with your life in a way.
Absolutely. And I think it's really been an accelerant where people ask themselves, you know, do I want to go work in a cubicle? Do I want to commute 40 minutes every day? I think those are really important questions. Life is just so exquisitely brief. And so, you know, maybe those were questions people would wait 10 years to ask themselves, but the pandemic maybe got some of us asking those questions. You know, what is it you really want to do with the 70 or 80 years, if you're really lucky, that you get here on Earth?
So, Tony, your story has an element of the present. It's set in a fictional town in Idaho in modern day, and it's told in part through the lens of Seymour. He's a teen, really has a sad and dark side to him. I think it's kind of tough to sympathize with this character. What were you trying to explore with him without giving too much away? Because a lot of us are still reading the book.
Got it. Yeah, of course. Seymour is Me, in many ways, you know, he's a little bit misanthropic, and he is sometimes more attached to animals or the natural world than he is to people. I'm the kind of person who at a cocktail party sometimes finds himself in like the bedroom with the coats and the dog, you know, petting the dog. I think he's so connected to this forest behind his house. I don't think it spoils too much to say this forest is raised in a housing development, as many of us in Idaho are seeing go up all around us. And he's so emotionally connected to those trees that when they're removed, he's really upset. And I think I was trying to channel some of my my questions about not only climate change, but the biodiversity crisis. You know, there's this twin crisis that's happening in the natural world around us that doesn't get nearly as much attention. You know, we've lost an enormous quantity of wild animals from the world just in our lifetimes, Gemma. So trying to understand and process that grief and those questions through Seymour and ask, you know, what are young people feeling right now? What kind of anger do they have against older generations? Seymour is a way to kind of put pressure on that. And hopefully if you stick with him for the whole journey of this long novel, you'll start to feel a little bit more attachment to him and understanding about where he's coming from.
Would you mind reading a part of the book? This is where we meet Seymour outside the Lakeport Library. I mean, we actually meet him in his car.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Lakeport's a made up town, but it's kind of McCall and maybe a little of Cascade and Ketchum mixed in. And I just really wanted to pay tribute to libraries in so many ways in this novel. And this little ramshackle rural library is hopefully an example of how these rural libraries are really lifelines for so many people. This is at the very beginning of the novel, and it's in winter, and it's in February of 2020. So hopefully the reader can kind of sense the pandemic looming as well. And he's just fallen asleep and woken up. The dashboard clock says 4:42 p.m. How long did he sleep? 15 minutes, 20 at most. Stupid, careless. He has been in the car for more than 4 hours, and his toes are numb, and he has to pee. With a sleeve, he clears vapor from the inside of the windshield. He risks the wipers once, and they brush a slab of snow off the glass. No cars parked in front of the library. No one on the sidewalk. The only car in the gravel parking lot to the west is Marion, the librarian's Subaru, humped with snow. 4:43 p.m. 6 inches before dark, says the radio. 12 to 14 overnight. Inhale for 4, hold for 4, exhale for 4. Recall things you know. Owls have 3 eyelids. Their eyeballs are not spheres, but elongated tubes. A group of owls is called a parliament. All he needs to do is stroll in, hide the backpack in the southeast corner of the library as close as possible to the Eden's Gate Realty office, and stroll out, drive north, wait until the library closes at 6 p.m., dial the numbers, wait 5 rings, boom, easy. I'll stop there, Gemma, so we don't run out of time.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, you talk about libraries, and I mean, that whole scene is set right out of the library. In fact, you dedicated Cloud Cuckoo Land to librarians. Why is that?
Oh, gosh. So the book is primarily set in the past, present, and future, really 3 time periods, 5 characters. Yeah. I'm trying to spin 5 plates in the reader's mind. So it is a lot to get off the ground. And I hope readers will bear with the first 120 so pages until you get all 5 characters introduced and kind of get all these big airplanes of these narratives, all 5 up in the air. And, you know, I mean, I have so many different answers for that question, Gemma. First, my mom was a science teacher, and she, you know, you don't realize this as a kid, but she was exhausted at the end of the day dealing with adolescents all day.
Oh, I bet. So
sometimes she would leave, you know, drop me and my brothers off at the library. It was really like the third place for us, you know, between home and school. And I just trying to keep up with the reading of my brothers. There's so many lessons you learn in the library, like learning to protect and care for public property when you bring a piece of a book home and you try not to spill your chocolate milk on it. And, you know, being able to understand, like, you know, there's books out there that I haven't tried yet. Just even glimpsing Virginia Woolf or Herman Melville's name on these shelves is so important. And the fact that you get to do that for free is really miraculous. And so it wasn't really until I'm in my 30s or 40s that you start to understand that these aren't just there like leaves on trees, that human beings keep the doors open. They keep the lights on. They keep the heat on. They keep the collections growing. So librarians really are stewards of human memory and human culture in a lot of ways. Mm. And so I tried to play with that in the past, present, and in the future section of the novel to try to say, you know, what does it mean to make little small gestures of stewardship in your life? What does it mean to try to just introduce one kid like this kid Seymour to a book about owls in the library room when he's a kid? And what will that do for the rest of his life?
Well, before we leave, I want to tell you a quick personal story. And that is, you and I have a mutual friend. And about 5.5 years ago, I have a brother who was diagnosed with cancer. And I asked my friend if I brought a book to her, if I got her a copy of All the Light We Cannot See, would you sign it? Because he wanted to be able to read during chemotherapy treatments. Well, about 2 days later, she came with a book. I didn't even have to get her a book that you had so signed.
Oh, Tim.
I apologize. Anyway, you signed the book. You sent him a note. It was lovely. My brother passed away, but he was able to read that book during his treatment. And we were able to have a conversation about that book. So I thank you much for giving him that gift at the end of his life. And I think that reading Cloud Cuckoo Land, when we see the interconnectedness of who comes before us and who comes after us. And so thank you. I always thought if I had the opportunity to talk to you that I would thank you for giving him that gift.
Thank you so much. That's so sweet. I'm so sorry for your loss. And I'm so grateful that we get to share that little thing. And, you know, it's such a reminder that every day is so such a gift. It's a cliche, but you just never know. And so I'm so grateful that I get to work in a profession where you get to learn every day and try to appreciate what an amazing opportunity it is to be alive on this earth. And
we absolutely won't be here
this long. So why not try to take care of it as much as we can for the next generation?
I thank you so much. Thank you. My apologies for getting emotional, but I wanted to share that with you. I thank you so much to Anthony Doerr. He will be featured January 13th at the Morrison Center for Reading and Conversation. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll be back tomorrow. Anthony, thank you so much.